Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the session on Vitalized Churches or Revitalization, part of the 2020 initiative that our fellowship is moving toward on a variety of fronts. And we're going to focus on the aspect today of church revitalization, and tomorrow again in the workshop, same time tomorrow, different room though. And so I'd just like to begin with basic idea that Vitalized Church is connected to church health, obviously. And just some kind of mountaintop observations we'll make about that. The presenters are going to be tomorrow afternoon, Bob Jones. He'll be talking about the connection to health between perseverance and fruitfulness. Just a great account of the journey in his ministry, his life, church, and there. So that'll be tomorrow afternoon. Then Derek Hamry is talking about revitalizing a declining church, something not so easy to do. Got a great story and some excellent substance there on that. Then Louis Hagebach, he's going to be talking about unlocking the potential of the rural church, the kind of church like I grew up in, and just a great story there that if you've got any connection or affinity with the rural church or the small church, unlocking the potential of that. I'll start off today in our first segment of this session, which will be the need for continual recatalyzation. First, let's go into that session. The need for continual recatalyzation traces back to the premise. You've maybe read Christian Schwartz's material on natural church development, that sort of thing. He makes this observation that healthy things grow, which is a generalization, is very true. And that's true about churches. But the thing in leadership that took me by surprise years back, I've been at the church that I'm at for 35 years, is that healthy things not only grow, but healthy things tend to plateau. Like they're always wanting to tend towards what will intercept that growth process in a variety of ways, but to take you into plateau. It just takes continual work every week, every staff meeting, every Sunday, every season of the year. You're always dealing with the fact that healthy things not only grow, but they also tend to want to plateau. And you could probably give lots of illustrations. We'll have some discussion on that momentarily. But here's the other and a little more ominous thing, that plateaued things tend to start to crust. In other words, without even trying and without thinking about it, you tend to start to corroborate the things that got you into the plateau. And it might be visitor sensitivity, it might be evangelization gaps, might be lacks of communication in equally informing the church to keep the momentum coordinated and moving down the road. But whatever it is, even without thinking and without trying, plateaued things tend to start to crust. In other words, the longer you've been plateaued, I think the harder it is to get back out of plateau and into a healthy, growing mode again. We'll see what you think about that, and you may disagree, but we'll just roll that out there for now. What we want to talk about first, and really a big part of this morning, is I want to hear what you have to say and your experiences in regards to this issue of plateau and decline. What leads to plateau and decline? There would be church factors and contextual factors. Contextual factors would be things like my friend who was pastoring, I'm from Alberta, he was pastoring in Western Alberta. Well, they closed the mine down and 3/4 of his congregation moved away. Well, that put you in plateau, probably in some decline. And it's important to know that. Like, we always take the primary onus responsibility on us when things start changing. But there are contextual factors. In fact, the uphill challenge in the Canadian context, I was just looking the other day at some Census Canada stuff back from the turn of the last century. You know that in 1901, Census Canada had registration of your religious affiliation, what do you think it was in 1901? Well, 98% of Canadians said they're Christian. By the 70s, the census in the 70s, I think it was 71, we were at about 77%. But by the time we got up to the modern, right today, 2011, it's 67% of Canadians saying they're Christian. Now, that's a contextual change that affects the local church as compared to 1900. And there was a lot of nominalism. I know just because they say that on a census doesn't mean they're saved, born again, and worshiping at a great church. But it's just a contextual change. It's changing the water in the fishbowl, so to speak. And it affects the way ministry rolls out for us. So those are contextual changes. But in church, there are changes that variety, you know, the Christian Swartz, Natural Church Development, they try and assess church health. What in church is causing perhaps non-health to start affecting the quality of our outreach and assimilation of people from the community? Our church has had to recatalyze, and I've been there 35 years, we've probably had to break out of plateau at least 10 times. So it's just not, well, we did that 6 years ago, that's over with. No, they're just healthy things tend to want to plateau. So we've had to recatalyze at least 10 times. We had times when in our staff plans we found we're hemorrhaging young adults. We're just not retaining our young adults. We did a worker analysis, I mean, back in the late 80s, and at that time, Fuller Church Growth offered that. We did an analysis and found that 87% of our dollars and our energies were all inbound. In fact, we were just a dearth of outbound evangelization type initiative. And that had found us in a plateau. There was another time, and this is the most expensive type of solution, when we found that we were, Peter Wagner used to say, sociologically strangled, which is basically facility. It's building, it's parking lot, it's whatever. We had 600 people in church, and we had 62 parking stalls. That's a problem. So we were strangling because of facility, and we had to, of course, address that. So there are a variety of reasons. And the church health groups, Christian Swartz, Natural Church Development, will assess church health in a variety of ways. We did a thing, vital signs of church health, your church can be healthy. We did a self-analysis as a congregation. Many good tools out there that probably you're using or familiar with. But they just, usually they're all taking a look at aspects of pastoral leadership, formational stuff, congregation, spiritual health, evangelism models, the type of groupings you're using for assimilating, connecting, and discipling people, small groups, mid-sized groups, all those sort of things. Anyway, you end up analyzing all of this in plateau and decline. But what I'm wondering and would kind of like to hear, whether it's church reasons or contextual reasons that have pressed us with decline, I'm wondering what sorts of things you've experienced in your 10 years of leadership and your context. We're representing probably all across the country here today. I'd like to hear what your thinking thoughts are on plateau and decline. And in the next segment, I'd like to have one more little discussion segment. I'll lead in with some discussion starters on how to get out. So in your comments, if you could just give reflections on this issue of plateau and decline. Like what I said, we had to, in 35 years, we had to address plateau 10 times in our church. You might say, no, I don't believe that. I mean, whatever. So whatever, there's lots of views. I'd just love to hear what your thinking is on plateau and decline. But on the solutions of it, we'll have a part B, a brief presentation by me, and then more discussion by you. So just your thinking thoughts on plateau and decline, whether it's contextual, whether it's church-based, what you think the reasons are. Obviously, you know, the church at Ephesus left their first love. There are spiritual factors in spiritual coldness that, regardless of your programming and your degrees and whatever, are going to induce plateau and decline. But what are some of your thinking thoughts on the issues of plateau and decline? in the Canadian church, or maybe church worldwide if you like, but we're in Canadian context, what are some of your thoughts on plateau and decline issues for churches? Yeah, fire away.
When you say plateau and decline, you're talking about growth?
Yeah, growth and attendance type stuff. Now, there'd be other health measures, you know. Nobody's reading their Bible and nobody's sharing their faith and whatever. You know, those are more the solution-based. Churches stop growing. It's a sign of health. Like, healthy things grow is the assertion, you know, that we're making. And you may want to disagree with that. That's cool, too. But, yeah, we're talking about growth issues. I mean, I bring this up because the PAOC has ostensibly been plateaued for 20 years. I mean, we see 1% growth, 1.5% growth, whatever. But compared to the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s in PAOC, it wasn't 1% growth. So we're essentially in a fellowship that, as wonderful as it is, has been plateaued for 20 years. And, yeah, and that's growth. That's numbers. That's bums and pews. That's people, you know. And so, good. Other thoughts on plateau and decline? Yeah.
One of the contextual issues that we face, we're in the Vancouver region, which is, so anyone in an urban region is probably familiarized with the fact that expensive housing causes an exodus of young families to move out further and further into the suburbs.
And that will play with your ministry strategy. Also, your context in Vancouver, studies I've seen about receptivity to greater involvement with religious groups. Quebec and BC are the toughest fields to cultivate, just attitudinally. And so that's a part of your factor that's different than for us on the prairies. Other things, your thoughts on plateau and decline. What's going on? Yeah. Great thought. We've got to grapple with that. It's not easy. It's not easy. Especially when you're as old as I am. It's hard to change. But great observation. Good. Other things. Plateau and decline. What are you seeing? What are you thinking? What are you experiencing? I think 60% of our PSU churches are plateaued or in decline. You know, the ACLR stuff and whatever. But so it's been, yeah, go. I remember Howard Ball saying years ago in a seminar, not ashamed of the power of gospel, for it's the power of God unto salvation. He said, if people aren't getting saved, he says, I'm suspicious that there's a dearth of sharing the gospel. And Selah, I think we need to think about that. Great, thanks. Yeah, go. Yeah.
Over the 20 years, right? If you have the same number of people over 20 years, you're counting the same, you know, you're coming up with the same number, but it's not the same people. Very often,
yes.
In an urban context,
there's
shifting, right? When the church does change. So even though if you say it's in plateau, it's not necessarily not changing. Like, everything's changing.
Yeah. Very, very good point. And Carl George used to say, if you don't grow by 10% a year, you'll decline, because 10% of the people move, relocate, whatever. So you've got to grow 10% just to replace the exodus. I see a couple of hands here and then on the corner here. Go. Yeah, good. Yeah.
Preaching it, praying for it, and also we have to close the back door of the church.
Those are two big statements. Hard to do, important to do. Lady here, and then gentleman here. Go.
Just one thought that came to mind is that often we know very well we're not from the world, but we forget that we are supposed to be in the world. And I often feel like people are really wanting people to come to church, and we're going to get them here, but I feel like I want to kick them out and say, go out. Like the church needs to go out, expand our walls. Like, we're supposed to be out. Like, why are we always trying to get them in? Why don't we go out where they are? This is what Jesus did. And I think it's something that we've got confused about and forgot that we're on a mission and we're different. We have a different identity, and it's good that we know that, but we have to be where they are comfortable. So I often challenge Christians to get uncomfortable so people can be comfortable in places where you share your life. Yeah. You open your life to them and you live with them, instead of wanting them to be where you feel comfortable, where you feel at home, where it's your comfort zone. You've got to be willing to go out, and something that
It's just so crucial. In our part B, when we talk about the solution-based approach to this, I think we need to get back into this and talk about how do you enable churches. I mean, we've got good people in our churches. They're good sheep. And how do we enable, empower, and facilitate them doing just what you said? But we'll get that in part B, sir, and then we'll switch into part B. In our church, you know what the stats are? It takes us 4 weeks to get half the people there once. When I came there 35 years ago, we had 60% of the people in the evening that we had in the morning. And just morning consistency, I think we had 60 or 70% of the people there every week. Now it takes us, we have some people that are once every 8 weeks, some people twice every 8 weeks, but it takes us 4 weeks to get half of our orbit there once. So you announce something, big announcement. In 4 weeks, you announce it every week and you've talked to half your orbit. That is so different than when I went to that church. So that's a big deal. Let's go on to this next thing, and then I want to dive into some of these other talks here. The moving parts of recatalyzation, and here's where I live, here's where you live. I love this. You know, we're called to ministry, we're called to pastor. This is our challenge, is to wrap our minds around, find the wisdom of God, what's pleasing to the Holy Spirit and to us in regards to the moving parts of recatalyzation. Because, and it has to start with us. You know, saying, I just forget who said this. If it's a Maxwell statement or whatever, it said, it's very hard for a church to rise above the level of its leadership. You can blame the people for a lot of things, and they have their faults and whatever, but it's really tough for them to take us hostage and make the church grow in spite of us. So somebody's got to own this thing, and I think it needs to be us. And so, okay, what are the moving parts to recatalyzation? I would say, you know, these are the players on the field. You've got pastor, staff, board governance, and congregation. At our church, we say we're pastor-led, board-validated, congregationally owned. But however you express that, pastor, staff, board, congregation, those are the moving parts. That's what you got to work with. When you talk about money, it's in the pockets of some of those people. If you talk about time to get out and be outbound, well, it's on the calendars of somebody in that four. We're going to do this. So I think that's what we got to work with. And it's going to fall within some of these parameters. There are six things that kind of sum up everything that happens in church. In ministry priorities, you've got worship, discipleship, evangelism. I mean, those are ginormous. They're big, comprehensive field. You're talking about revival. You're talking about prayer. You're talking about the baptism of the Holy Spirit, whatever. But it all falls in there. The type of experience that people have when they come to the church. I remember inviting someone to our church that I attended when I was in secular work. And I brought the guy there, and I was dying through the whole service because nothing in that service was connecting with the guests that I brought. And, you know, you can have, you know, snippy attitudes, you don't want to be critical and whatever and that, but I just realized the church that I was part of at that time was so unoriented to anybody inbound It was very tough for us to grow in that community. Now, maybe the answer is some of the evangelization stuff happens in homes and in other places and whatever. It's not all got to be in the church every time. But anyway, I'm getting into more than I should here. But so you've got worship, discipleship, and evangelism. Then operationally, you've got leadership. You've got program, which is a strategy of ministry. It's just Paul's missionary journeys were the first programs in Acts. You know, you have strategies of ministry. How are we going to reach a lost world? Leadership, program, and then facilities. If you're in Africa, I've had services under a thorn tree. It's hard to do in Edmonton in February. You pretty much need facilities to do it where we are. And you can rent them, they can be humble, they can be elaborate, whatever. But facilities play a role. So leadership, program, facilities. Back to you. What are your thinking thoughts on recatalyzation? Like, folks, God helping us, we got to do this, right? Yes, ma'am.
I'm from Quinnipiac, New Brunswick.
Great.
And about a year and a half ago, we had a new pastor come in, and he has revitalized the church, and he's done it by giving everyone in the congregation some job.
Okay.
And that makes them feel important.
Yep. Oh, man.
We've never been there before. We've probably not, some of them not been in any church. And it's because almost everybody in the congregation has some kind of a job. Huh. And our congregation probably is about maybe 150.
Yeah.
Around.
Yeah.
And I just thought that's something that.
I love it. That's the kind of church I want to go to. It's great. Somebody else, recatalyzation, and we're on the solution track here right now with the moving parts, pastor, staff, board, congregation, and then leadership program, facilities, worship, discipleship, evangelism, boom, boom, boom. Where do we go? How do we recatalyze churches? Yeah. Wow, I love that. You know, what you just said was an axiom every one of us can take home, in that the test of leadership is in your ability to lead people through the process of change. And that's what you had to do. I mean, you know, there's some people who know there's a problem, there's some people who know why there's a problem, and then there's other people who know how to fix a problem. You led people through the process of change, having identified what the impasse was. Boy, I think, and that involved pastor, board, maybe some key influencers, who knows, but you figured that out, you let it through, and some health has ensued. Good, other things, recatalyzation, moving parts, what do we do? Yep. Boy, inbound. You know, that one picture I picked, you know, when things tend to plateau, I looked for a picture of a root-bound plant. You know, it just root-bound. It's that pot has ceased to live and expand, and an inbound church that doesn't have a kingdom culture. I love that. Somebody else, catalyze it. Yeah, go.
Take care of these whole numbers. 50
51% take care of the soul. Yeah. 49% going down, take care of the 99 people who are already saved. Because Jesus said, I will build my church. And yeah. we are built. And the gates of hell will never prevail against us.
Yeah.
But look to the one who's lost souls,
yeah.
like you.
Yeah.
Remember when I first saved you, Dominic?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's my,
yeah,
that's my yeah. heart for you.
Well, that's the heart of the outbound shepherd.
49% for the bodies, 51% for the
yeah, I love it. Go ahead, ma'am.
My husband and I started working in a church 9 months ago, Far East in Quebec, and it was a church that will actually be celebrating 60 years old anniversary next year, so it's a pretty old church for a Quebec church. But it was very much on the decline, and they hadn't had pastors for a while, so it was tough. But one thing that I feel often where people say we're still in the honeymoon stage, I don't know what it is, I want to stay in it.
Yeah.
But it's just that we have that sense compared to the people who've been there for years, who've been disappointed and sad about what God was not doing or what we were expecting and not happening. We came with a desire to see God move. And we led with that all the time, saying we expect God to do things here. And even though there wasn't always incredible out there things he was doing, but we chose to celebrate every Sunday what God was doing in people's life and small things. So they would focus more on what God was doing than not what he was not doing.
Yeah.
And we felt like people started to get more excited and get on board. And every week we would try to lead by vision to say that we were still expecting God to do things and that he was already doing it. And we have two communities, one in French and one in English, and the French one actually almost tripled since we got there, but it's just that sense of excitement. And we felt for other English church, it was harder, we didn't sense that sense of we expect God to do things until last Sunday, when finally we just felt like people got it and they started getting excited. I guess they were just more cautious
yeah.
and just, but that sense to celebrate what God is already at work and to, as the leaders expect great things to happen, I think, even if people are not seeing it, if you repeat it over and over and you do believe it and want to be part of it, I think it really helps people to look forward instead of just looking backward.
Wow. Wow. And with 8 million Quebecois in this country, that's great news. Let me wrap up with this. You need to hear Louis. One of the things that in one fashion or another, in our recurrent efforts to recatalyze our predisposition to plateau as a church, was one of the perpetual solutions was always outbound evangelization. And of late, what we focused on tremendously in the last years and all years, but is the idea of invitational culture. You know, pastors don't give birth to all the sheep in the flock. It's people. People have the connections. They go to university. They're working. They take their kids to kindergarten with the neighbors and whatever. So they have their orbits of influence. And the idea of invitational culture, I think, is the dynamo. Spirit-anointed, not just humanistically, but I mean spirit-anointed invitational culture, that people come and they get, because most more and more people are spiritually illiterate, scripturally illiterate today. They weren't raised like I was in church settings. So they need to come and hear something that is an orthodox representation of the historic Christian faith. And what we have just put most of our eggs in our baskets are an invitational culture, getting people into comfortable, relaxed settings where they can hear Christianity unpacked, be able to discuss it and say, I've never heard this, I disagree with this, or whatever, interesting. And so we are on board. We use Alpha, hugely, and plans to use it even nationally, where churches will just do the simplest thing. Like, people can't give complex defenses of the faith. They're not all PhD scholars like you heard this morning, but they can all invite. The lowest rung on the ladder of evangelization is invitation, and everybody can do it. And to a home, a family room, a church, an exercise club, whatever, get them there. Use these new Alpha platforms that are just phenomenal. They've upgraded this to like state of the art, and invite people to come into relaxed relational settings, let them hear the Christian faith. And you know, I think, as you've been saying, the Spirit of God will do his job. We can't convert anybody. We can't persuade anybody. But get them where they can hear the virile, authentic gospel, have some relational connection, and I think we can see this thing turn around. I really think we can. But we can't just roll the dice. I think we need to mobilize churches invitationally, have something great evangelistically for them to experience when they come. And I think Alpha is premier, but there are many other good tools. And I think that's the need of the hour, is for us to lead intentionally in those ways. Louis, come and take us home.
Thanks, Gary. That was great. Hey, guys. Yeah, give Gary a round of applause. My name is Louis Hulbgewax, and it's a privilege to be here in the Quebec district and talking with you guys. I'm the pastor of onechurch.ca. We believe that at some point this internet thing is going to catch on. The rest of you can laugh. That's actually funny. I've been asked to share our story from a rural setting, and then afterwards I'm just going to share a couple of practical kind of thoughts that we implemented that helped us, and hopefully they can help you, and then after that we're going to have a Q&A open to any of the four of us who are presenting. Our family moved to southeastern Saskatchewan in 2003, so almost be 13 years ago next month. We moved there to pastor two churches that were 13 kilometers apart. And 13 kilometers apart on the prairies is about the same equivalent as four blocks here. There's 13 kilometers, there's not a dog in between, and there's a very small town in one location, another small town in another location. One of the two churches didn't like each other at all, and one actually really didn't like the PAOC. They had joined the PAOC about a decade earlier because they were looking for some group who could find a pastor to send into the middle of nowhere. And after being rejected by two or three other denominations, the PUC said, we'll take anybody. And they sent me there. So my wife and I moved into the community of Carlisle, which is the big community of 1,500 people. And we were numbers 11 and 12 in the congregation. Manor, the second community with the second church that was 13 kilometers away, had a total population of about 200 people. The church in Carlisle had church history. It was actually birthed out of a church split. The group had actually kicked the PAOC out a decade prior, and there was a remnant that had been kicked out that said, we believe God is calling us to continue on, and they kept holding services for a decade with about 10 people until our family showed up in 2003. When we showed up, this is the question that came to us and challenged us. Would your community even notice if your church shut its doors next week? Would your community even notice, other than there might not be a couple cars parked in a parking lot, if your doors of the church that you are in closed next week? And if you honestly evaluate that question, and if you'd come to the answer, actually our community wouldn't notice. They wouldn't even blink an eye. It should break your heart. Because if we as individuals and corporately are the temple of God on earth, the dwelling place of God's Spirit, and that was taken away, taken out of a community, that community should ache. Because that tangible presence is no longer there. And we looked, and we evaluated, and it broke our hearts. And it drove us to 1 Corinthians 9, 19, and 22. Paul writes these words, "Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible." And in verse 22, he says this, "I've become all things to all men so that by all possible means I might save some." From those two verses, our congregation came up with three decrees that we agreed on as a congregation, and these are them. We agree as a congregation to do anything short of sin to win people to Jesus Christ. We agree as a congregation to remove any barriers, hindrances, or walls that deter people from coming to Christ and his bride, the church. And we agreed as a congregation that we will make a difference, that people's lives will be forever changed because we are obedient to the call of Jesus on our lives. Anything short of sin. Re-examining church. Do we do what we do because it's tradition? Do we do what we do because it's commanded in Scripture, or do we do what we do simply because it's sentimental? Do we do what we do because it's what we've always done? As I said, me and my wife were numbers 11 and 12 in Carlisle. As we move forward with these tenets in mind over the next couple of years, we had massive growth. We grew from 12 to about 50. Brand new believers. And when we got to 50, the 10 that were there when we showed up were like, oh, Pastor, finally we have enough people to start doing church. And my plea was, guys, the reason we've seen growth is not because we've been doing church. It's because we've been looking at new and creative ways to reach out and go beyond ourselves to connect with our community. Removing barriers, hindrances, or walls that deter people from coming to Christ and His bride, the church. From a good friend of mine, also from Saskatchewan, we gleaned the term pre-evangelism. What can we do to help set the stage to make people more comfortable to step into what we know as a relationship with Jesus Christ and the church? Our church building had some church history in the community, and we decided that we wanted the church to be a central place in our community. When people wanted to celebrate, they thought of the church. When they mourned because things were going sideways in their lives, they thought of the church. We ripped out our pews, and we transformed our sanctuary into a multi-purpose room. And what we did in Saskatchewan is we actually purchased a number of large inflatable bouncy castles. And we set up an indoor playland for our community in our sanctuary during the weekdays. We have a couple cold months in the year in Saskatchewan. I don't know if you guys are aware of that or not, but every Sunday after service we tear down, and every Saturday we set back up. And during those couple cold winter months that we have in Saskatchewan, we've created a safe, fun environment for families in our corner of the world to come. And the most incredible thing happened. There's now people who don't yet attend our church who show up and make coffee for one another and serve one another and bring their friends. And there's nothing more fun than seeing a little three-year-old screaming, "Mommy, I don't want to leave church!" I know he's there because of the bouncers. At the same time, he's also there because the people of God had a heart for people who are not yet in the church. And it's amazing because, have you ever had the experience where you've walked into an unknown building? You go up to these big, massive wooden doors that create this barrier, and you think you're in the right place, but you're not quite sure, and you reach out, and with great trepidation, you kind of pull the door forward and peek your head in. In a community of 1,500 people, we have had thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people come through our church doors. They know where the washrooms are, they know the lay of the land, they know where the coffee pot is, and it's become a place where they just come together and they naturally connect. And they know that the church is here to serve, not just to take. I wasn't feeling any pressure, and I wasn't pausing for a... The other thing and the idea of pre-evangelism was about 9 years ago, we started streaming our services online. We started audio, then we started really low-quality video. But it allowed anyone to check out what was going on behind the church doors without having to step through the doors for the first time. It took down another barrier. Today, we actually have another campus, a second campus in Redverse, which is 50 kilometers down the road, that we actually live stream our services into. And so every Sunday, there is now a vibrant, healthy church that wasn't there before, 50 kilometers down the road, that we live stream our Sunday messages into. I had the most interesting experience about 6 months ago, 8 months ago. I've had a couple times since then. They're like, oh, I'm walking around, and all of a sudden somebody's like, oh, Pastor, oh, how are you, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I'm great. I don't have a clue who you are. But they see me most Sundays on the screen, right? And we've got a local lay pastor that runs a church of about 40 people now, 50 kilometers down the road. I also got an email a little while back that said, Pastor Louie, I'd be interested to know what your thoughts were when you started video streaming Sunday services. I suspect no one would have figured that a fellow member would be following from the Middle East in Qatar. That's for sure. We are from an oil community, and we've got people who have some connection to Carlisle, but also in the Middle East. And there's actually a group of oil drillers in the Middle East that actually follow our Sunday services now. From Saskatchewan. Amen. Leveraging technology in rural settings. in settings that are small. You know, we've got settings that are 500 to 1,000 people. They don't have enough resources to hire a staff member. They don't have enough resources for maybe a facility. But there's these groups of people who need to know Jesus, and we've been finding ways to leverage technology to bring vibrant, healthy church into their local settings. In Saskatchewan, our church plant model has always been find one guy who you'd pay almost nothing to, put him in the middle of nowhere, expect him to preach powerfully on Sunday, visit the elderly, do the youth ministry, run the children's programming, eventually burn him out, send him on his way, and then pray as hard as you could until you could find another sucker who would show back up, who once again you could pay almost nothing to. We're looking at doing things differently, and through leveraging technology, we're changing how that works. OneChurch.ca, because we're one church in multiple locations, and we're actually in the process of looking towards planting a third location, another 100 kilometers away. We agreed as a congregation that we'll make a difference, that people's lives will be forever changed because we were obedient to the call of Jesus on our lives. God has been very good to us. We started in Carlisle. We were numbers 11 and 12. The church 13 kilometers away, after we implemented these changes in Carlisle, the church in Manor didn't, and they continued to plateau. And a few years later, they decided they were really a subset of Carlisle. So that church actually closed. But what was interesting is in Carlisle, we had 35 brand new believers who had no Christian background. They had all the fire in the world, but no maturity. In Manor, we had 8 people left who had all the maturity in the world but had no passion. Their fire was, and my one friend would say their wood was wet. Their fire, it was gone because they were just trying to keep up a facility. And the most incredible thing happened. These 8 mature believers came and joined us, and these 35 brand new believers, and they connected and natural discipleship happened, and literally within a matter of months, we went from 50 to 60 to 150. Because the people of God got involved in each other's lives, and the mature people discipled the new believers, and the new believers' passion reignited the passion of the old believers. In 2003, my wife and I were numbers 11 and 12 at the Carlisle campus. Today, we run 2 services at the Carlisle campus. We run a service via video 50 kilometers down the road in Carlisle. We have just over 200 people on an average Sunday morning, and 75% are brand new to faith since we've been there. And it is a blast to pastor people who are new to faith. And if you haven't done it, I'd encourage you to give it a try. That's our story in a really condensed nutshell. A couple of practical thoughts from us, looking at things from a rural setting. Anything short of sin. That not only means being creative in new ways, it can also mean ending some present ways. My experience when we first moved and were pastoring 2 very small, very rural churches is that they were trying to do everything. And we were officially doing everything very, very poorly. And we started hacking and chopping. Because I would rather do a couple things exceptional than do everything poorly. And we serve a God of awe and wonder, and we do church programmings that make you... So we trimmed back a lot of stuff. But we made sure that what we were going to do was outreach-focused, and we were going to do what we could do exceptionally well. And I think one of the people made a comment along these lines. One of the things that happened, there was, you know, one of the golden calves was the fall harvest senior supper, blah, 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 blah. And one of the things I went back to was, guys, what was your heart when you started this? Because we're not fulfilling the heart. So actually, by ending this program and starting something new, we're actually being truer to ourselves than keeping this program running. When a small church tries to do everything, nothing ultimately is done well. The other thing that I experienced in that premise is that we end up burning people out faster than we can bring them in. So we end up reinforcing the cycle. The other thing that I noticed is that in that scenario, the tail ends up wagging the dog. Because we get this mentality that, pastor, we can't lose another family. Pastor, there's too much work to do already. We can't lose another family. I know they're crotchety, and I know they're sinful. I know they're all of this, but look, but pastor, we've got to give in to their will and their ways because we can't lose another family because there's too much work to do for us already. So you get to a place where you self-fulfill, and Evaluate your events. Evaluate the impact they're having on those outside of the church. Another little nugget, there was an article in the Enrich magazine from, like, I don't know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, a long time ago, more than 10 years ago, 15 years ago. It's called How to Minister Effectively In, and it talked about family-sized churches, 0 to 50, pastor-sized churches, 50 to 150, program-sized, corporate-sized. We found that incredibly helpful, that little article. I got a copy on my phone, but it gave us the pitfalls for what would happen at certain sizes of church health, and it lined up incredibly true to our story. And one of the keys for us, one of the keys that we knew, was that there needed to be longevity as pastors, as leaders. Because the history in our smaller settings, at least in rural Saskatchewan, is that the pastor comes and then 3 years later he gets burnt out and leaves. The new pastor comes with a new vision, 3 years later gets burnt out and leaves. And after that's happened for a couple of times, guess what the church does not want to hear? The new vision of the pastor, because guess what? You're going to get us started in this, and in 2 years, you're gonna leave. And especially when it comes to maybe confronting some power families in the church. Because the reality is that we can know that the patriarch or the matriarch of the church is sinful, but we know we're going to be stuck with them, and in 2 years, you're going to leave. So when there was this idea that we're going to be here for the long term, and all of a sudden there was this shift in thinking, because all of a sudden they were very open. And today it's amazing, because we have a congregation, again, that has grown up around us. And stepping into new adventures is a far easier and a more fun task to do than it was in the past. Community focused. Where does your community itch? Where can we as the church scratch? How can we be a blessing to our local community? For us, one of the big things was Playlands. We've done a number of other things. But for our community in southern Saskatchewan, where we have lots of cold winter months and no place for families to go, that was ideal. What is it for you? The question is where is there an itch in our community that we could scratch? Where could we, the church, serve our community instead of just hoping and praying that they would simply come to us? Being focused on that. Another focus for us specifically was actually we focused on the guys. We focused on the men. A statistic we read a long time ago from Steve Sonderman said, when a child comes to faith, 9% of the time they can influence an unchurched family to become Christians. When a wife or woman comes to faith in the same situation, only 13% of the time her influence will cause the family to come to faith. But when a man comes to faith, 93% of the time the entire family will come to faith and become participants in the church. Now, I don't want to diminish all the moms and ladies and women. You guys are a backbone of so many of our congregations and churches. But on a simply statistic basis, if you can reach the guys, you reach the whole family. And we realized we had limited resources because there was 12 of us. And so with limited resources, we actually started focusing specifically on the guys. So we started asking questions. What would make the average guy in our what would make the average guy in our context comfortable? What language would the average guy in our community understand? What barriers, hindrances, or walls are keeping the average guy out of the church? One of my all-time pet peeves, and if you've done this, I'm sorry, but one of my all-time pet peeves, we preach on the armor of God, and we bring up a dollar store plastic shield and a dollar store plastic sword, and we preach about the armor of God. That inspires no one. Scripture, man, there is some wild stuff in our Bible. We preach about the armor of God, we get a full body suit of armor. We bring out a 4 foot long sword on stage, and you can see the guys light up. Your men should leave grunting, I think. Anyways, that's me. A lot of churches actually have a lot of barriers just by the simple decor of their church that make it kind of unfriendly to guys. There's something amazing about you women. It's absolutely amazing. You ladies can come into a male kind of type environment and adapt and thrive. Guys who show up in a female environment just don't come back again. They just check out. If you think about it this way, a lot of women show up at sporting events. Almost no men show up at candle parties. Right? Right? So we were very intentional about the decor of our church, about our language, about how we preached, about how we presented the message, the gospel. Who's had a license for over 20 years? Who's still driving the exact same car you drove 20 years ago? Nobody, right? The Word of God never changes. The gospel never changes, but how we deliver it has to. Absolutely has to. The car we had 20 years ago had a steering wheel and tires and an engine and a transmission. So does the vehicle we drive today. But why don't we drive that one? Because it's not comfortable anymore. But, right? The gospel never changes, but how we deliver the gospel has to. The language that we use in general, just being very conscious about, we live in an unchurched world, guys, right? And we've got lots of rich Christian words that if you don't come to church mean nothing. I've been thinking about presenting here and listening to us over the last couple of days. Man, if you don't come to church, you listen to some conversations, nobody has a clue what we're talking about. We use so much Christianese. And so we were very intentional with the idea we were going to be outward focused. Still share the same truth, still define the same truths in powerful ways, but we use language that our context in rural Saskatchewan understands. Does that make sense? Two last real quick things, well, maybe three last real quick things. For us, one of the other things that has had a big impact on us, and we stumbled upon it a little bit, is we've done mission trips for a decade now down to Mexico, and we started by driving a 15-passenger van, and we upgraded to purchasing a 48-passenger coach kind of bus. But something incredible happens when you're stuck in a vehicle with someone for 50 hours. You get beyond the weather. Because you know what happens Sunday morning when everyone shows up? How is everybody? Everyone's fine. How are you? I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. I'm fine. You're fine. Everybody's fine. It's amazing how Sunday morning everyone's fine. And Sunday afternoon everyone's life falls apart. For us, so I don't know what it is for you guys. For us, it works really well. But you get stuck in a vehicle for 50 hours with somebody, you get beyond the weather. One of the most powerful, you know, I woke up at 3 in the morning. We're driving through the mountains on the way south. And three people who have been a part of a church at that point actually for quite some time, but had never known one another. One's talking about his struggle with alcoholism. One's talking about how he had major third-degree burns over his entire body in an oil field accident. The other one's talking about how she was adopted and her struggles. I shut up. I kept my ear open. And I heard these three people who have spent years in the same church actually get to know one another. And that has parlayed into the fact we've taken 230 or 40 people now down to Mexico on these trips. But for us, it works. But somehow getting your people into a state where they get beyond the weather. The other thing for us is we created something in the fall called a 4-week challenge. It's whatever it is, but something that created talk and buzz in our community. What we found out is there's actually a number of people who wanted to come out to church. They just didn't want to be the only new person who came out to church. And all of a sudden, it kind of like created like almost like an open house effect. They were like, oh, these are the Sundays when new people come out to church. And they didn't feel uncomfortable. It was the weirdest thing. First year we did it, 12 new families showed up. And the other thing is it actually gave our congregation something to talk about, right? All of a sudden they heard people talking downtown. What's this 4-week challenge thing? They thought it was a health issue, but then they seen me and they realized that wasn't the issue. But all of a sudden our congregation was like, oh, wait a sec. Oh, that's us. That's us. Let me tell you about that. And it created this invitational environment. We did the 4-week challenge, try church again. We double dog dare you. Come out for 4 consecutive Sundays, and if your life isn't changed at the end, no harm, no foul. But what if after 4 consecutive Sundays, your life was forever changed? We did then creative advertising and some edgy advertising, and we had these posters and these lawn signs and everywhere, the papers and all over the place, that simply said 4-week challenge. Now, in our community, we're rural, right? So we didn't even have the church name, nothing. Just had 4-week challenge everywhere. And then on the posters that were edgy, we had that same logo connected. But then all of a sudden, people started talking naturally. What is this 4-week challenge? What is this all about? And all of a sudden, you know, some would connect it with the other advertising, and others would just be talking about it in community, and all of a sudden our congregation's like, wait a second, this is my opportunity. The pastor told me this was going to happen. That's us. What was I supposed to say again? All right, but for us, it worked. It created this idea of context. My last moment here, guys, the other thing is just talk about real issues that non-Christians are facing. To the last about 7 years in our church, we've had Sex Sunday. The last 6 years, we've done Porn Sunday. That was a lot of fun announcing. One congregant said to me, Pastor, When you first announced we were doing Porn Sunday, I thought, oh my goodness, you've gone and done it. You're officially done. You can't recover from this. And then I explained the fact that we've got people who are trapped in the addiction of pornography, and we've got people in the sex industry who are trapped in that industry, and they need to find freedom as well. And we need to be people who reach out. And it's been amazing. We got signs and banners. We've had drunk guys show up at kids' club. What's this porn thing you've got out front? We've also had 8 and 9-year-olds go to their parents crying because of their iPods. These images have flashed up, and it's tearing them apart inside. And we've had 50-year-olds who have been in church their entire lives who have not been able to find freedom. And we started talking about it. It's just a real issue. It doesn't have to be that, but talk about real issues. And for non-church people, you know, I hope you guys hear this correctly. Non-church people don't care whether we're post, pre, or popcorn tribulation. Like, and not that that's not valid, and not that we don't preach the entire counsel of God's word, but when we're talking about those who do not yet know Christ, that is so not a question on anyone's mind. I'm done. Thanks for hearing me out. Questions for any one of the four of us? If I get the other three guys to stand up real quick. Derek and Bob are going to be presenting tomorrow. You guys need to come back and hear what they've got to say. And you heard my esteemed colleague here earlier. So I guess I'm the one quarterbacking the Q&A, but the questions don't have to be specifically for me. But anybody got anything they want to ask any one of us?
Yeah, it's not a question so much as good for you, man. A lot of people run from rural settings, and to hear you say, I'm going to go there, led by God, I'm going to go and serve my socks off, love it. We live in a culture, people at my age, 30 and down, we're thinking to ourselves, we don't want to go rural, we'll never go rural. We want to go urban, we want to go big. I love what you're doing. Keep doing it. Keep doing it strong, keep doing it faithfully, and we'll just try and be other people. Keep doing what you're doing creatively. Love it, very inspiring.
Thanks. Yes, I was from Saskatchewan.
Oh, okay. So you didn't look like the outsider
initially. I didn't grow up in the church. I grew up Catholic. I was an altar boy into my early 20s. So I didn't have a lot of... I went to church, but I didn't know nothing, really. Like, we were very nominal. I was an altar boy, but... So when I came to faith and when we moved into church, when I started at Carlisle on staff, I still had a... I was very talented enough to stuff a 4-year degree into 12 years. So I actually just graduated. I went on sabbatical. I missed my convocation because I was actually on my sabbatical. So I didn't have a lot of church background baggage. So for us, when I went into stuff and I seen that this isn't working, it really wasn't. I didn't have some struggles like, well, this is how we always done it or that. But I wasn't necessarily an outsider either. The community we moved into, I'd never been to before. But I definitely had an understanding for rural Saskatchewan. Any other questions for me or any one of the other guys?
Are we able to get the courage and willing to take the risk of doing all of that?
I don't know. We were just going to be obedient to God, you know. When we left, I took a 66% pay cut to leave a job to go pastor, a part-time job to go pastor 2 churches. Which was kind of nuts, but God just called us, and it was, you know, I never applied for the position. God just called us, and we just thought, God, we've given you everything, and this is either going to go forward or it's going to explode. But so, yes.
When you first started making changes, did you encounter resistance, and if so, did you overcome it? How did you overcome it, or were people so aware of the need for change that they said, we'll do anything?
I had a good group that wanted to see people come to Christ. The reality is every church says they want to grow, but that's not true. Every church says they want to grow, but we're meant to be fishes of men, but we want our fish to show up in Highliner boxes. Does that make sense here? Okay, to make sure that's not just a Saskatchewan thing. We want all of our fish to be pre-formatted, pre-shaped, and breaded. A couple of things. We did have a good group that ultimately said they wanted to see people come to Christ. But there was resistance along the way. One of the things early on, I mean, it was very clear who was the patriarch in our small group. And for the first about 12 months, I realized if I can sow the seed with him, 6 months later, he thinks it's his idea, and it gets accomplished, and I don't have to do any work. So it was, for a lot of the early strategy was simply sowing the seed with who was the patriarch and being okay with me not getting the credit. And then there was the time where it was, okay, guys, if we have to change or die. And we talked a little bit last night with all my conversations. Sometimes we talk about don't do anything new for 6 months or a year. Sometimes we need to do radical change and we need to do it now. Because incremental change just doesn't work. Somebody was talking the other night with me. Because incremental change, we just get sucked back into the old way of doing things. So at some point, it does need to be radical and instant.
In your advertising signage and so on, did you ever run into a situation where a local resident complained to the local government's authorities? And what did council do with it? And how did you overcome it if that was the situation?
If nobody's talking about you, you're not doing anything. We've had lots of interesting comments and complaints. We've nearly caused traffic accidents in front of our vehicle, in front of our church. We've had little old grannies driving by, and all of a sudden you hear the brakes screech and reverse and back up, and people hanging out their window taking pictures of the church signage because we got interesting advertising out front. We've never had to go any legal ramifications, but we've gotten used to the fact that people are going to talk about us and not positively. But they're talking. And at the same time, especially it's interesting because we get a lot of, churches shouldn't talk about sex. Churches shouldn't talk about that. But our congregation's at the point now where it's like, well, why not? And our congregation has got to a place where it's become a natural thing. It's like, well, actually the one place that should be talking about sex is the church because we know the designer. Yeah. And we're the one place that's not. And our society sells everything with sex and we don't say anything. And when you're fighting a war without any weapons or ammunition or anything else, you're not winning. So we were okay. We got to a place where we're just okay with people talking about us in whatever context. But they were talking, and when they did talk, we got to a place where even our congregation, all of a sudden we're this idea of, this is a trigger point. This is my opportunity. Oh, they're saying something crazy and about our church, or we're questioning something. Well, this is my opportunity to step in and say, actually, give me the full story. Well, actually, the reason we talk about this is A, B, and C. And they're like, oh, and it's amazing, almost every time. It's like, oh, yeah, that's a real issue. And that's actually a real issue that I face within my immediate sphere of influence. And wow, I wish somebody maybe would have talked with me about that. So, anyways.
The first few that came to faith, how did you share that with your congregation? How did they share their testimony? What was the impact?
How did the testimony of the first few that came to faith? The first few came to faith through personal relationship right at the start. The other thing is, guys, we worked hard. Like, we need to let God do what only He can do, but we can do what we can do. So we worked hard. We tried to create that culture within our small group of relational, getting to know people and inviting them in. And we, as the staff or the pastor at that time, I mean, there was only 10 other congregants outside of my wife and I, and we got involved in people's lives and got involved in the community and got to know people. And I went fishing with a guy. The only time that would work in our schedules was Sunday morning. I preached twice Sunday morning, Manor in Carlisle. So I got up at 4:30 in the morning so we could get on the lake by 5:30. I fished with him from 5:30 to 8:30, raced like crazy to get done and get back so I could get to Manor about 50 kilometers away so I could preach a 9:30 service. I did that for a couple months. And then a couple months after that, I invited him to church. And a couple months after that, he showed up at church. And their entire family has had a radical transformation. And so early on, today I don't go fishing on Sunday mornings anymore. But it wasn't for the fact of going fishing. It was the fact of spending time with somebody who wasn't a Christian, being very real. I didn't club him over the head with the gospel. I became his friend. And when he started asking questions and sharing, I shared. And actually, they had some, yeah. And so stuff like that, and initially it was more heavy on us when there was only 12 of us, but it was getting that kind of culture into the church.
So when you had that many come that quickly, what was your discipleship
A lot of it was very organic off the start as those mature believers came in. They actually, what happened is that they all of a sudden realized that there's these young new people of faith who actually want to know more and that they knew more. And so all of a sudden they just, it was very natural and organic at the start where all of a sudden they just kind of stepped in and all of a sudden like there was a half dozen or a dozen people who just, you know, all of a sudden circled around this couple and another dozen circled around this couple. And then beyond that, we used Alpha a lot early on. We ran midweek studies and that. No real specific, you know, program along those lines. But it for us, it worked just very organically, especially with those the mature believers who came in. Like, it was just people connected. But it's even getting the people who are in your church who are maybe the, sometimes they're the thorn in your side, but they've also been around the church and know, they know the faith, somehow getting them to realize that there's new people who they can actually pour into. And all of a sudden, it gives them purpose. And all of a sudden, it's amazing. People start coming to faith. Nobody cares the color of the carpet anymore. Like it's just, right? It's just, it changes something. I think our time is up, but I'm free for any other questions. These guys are free for all sorts of questions. Thanks for coming out, guys.